Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour with their analysis, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Megan Goldberg with us as well, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Ben.
And you can join us as well as a River to River listener on Politics Day, of course, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about the college protests over the Israel-Gaza war continuing to spread in the country, the hush money criminal trial of Donald Trump, also two Supreme Court cases. Does the president have absolute immunity from prosecution? Also, one that was heard today, whether federal law requiring hospitals to provide emergency care applies to abortions in life-threatening situations, even in states with strict abortion bans. Also, toward the end of the hour, I hope to ask Megan and Wayne about their reflections on another year of the Iowa legislature, just gaveling out this past weekend, a session marked by Republican priorities once again. But first of all, the top of our news yesterday, the Senate approved aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Today, President Biden signed it. This is a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed last night after months of debate, delivering weapons to key U.S. allies. Both of Iowa's U.S. senators, Grassley and Ernst, voted in favor, the aid could arrive in Ukraine this week. Of course, a crucial boost ahead of an expected Russian offensive. The bill also forcing the Chinese-owned TikTok to be sold or banned in the U.S. Before we go to Megan Wayne, let's hear this voice from, first of all, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, what he had to say after passage.
Getting this done was one of the greatest achievements the Senate has faced in years, perhaps decades. A lot of people inside and outside the Congress wanted this package to fail. But today, those in Congress who stand on the side of democracy are winning the day. To our friends in Ukraine, to our allies in NATO, to our allies in Israel, and to civilians around the world in need of help, help is on the way. To our friends in Ukraine, America will deliver more ammo and air defenses and basic supplies that you need to resist Putin on the battlefield. To our friends in Israel, America will soon deliver aid to help you fight the scourge of Hamas and stand up to Iran. To innocent civilians in the midst of the war, in the midst of war, from Gaza to Sudan, America will deliver food and medicine and clothing. And to our friends in the Indo-Pacific, we will stand with you to resist the Chinese Communist Party. And to the whole world, make no mistake, America will deliver on its promise to act like a leader on the world stage, to hold the line against autocratic thugs like Vladimir Putin.
The final vote in the Senate, 79-18. Senators voting no included 15 Republicans. Also Democrats, Jeff Merkley, Peter Welch, and independent Senator Bernie Sanders. Here's some of what he had to say.
We are now in the absurd situation where Israel is using U.S. military assistance to block the delivery of U.S. humanitarian aid to Palestinians. If that is not crazy, I don't know what is, but it's also a clear violation of U.S. law. Given that reality, we should not today even be having this debate. It is illegal to continue current military aid to Israel, let alone send another $9 billion with no strings attached.
Senator Sanders yesterday before the passage of the bill. Join us, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Wayne, to you first of all, your takeaways from this long, twisting path to pass this aid. I think the first supplemental bill request from the president came what, last August or September, I believe.
That's correct. First of all, to the extent that you think Ukraine, independent Ukraine, and a Taiwan that is not controlled by the communist China, the aid makes a lot of sense. So the problem is it got involved in domestic politics, got delayed in the House of Representatives. I think the way the bill was finally constructed in the House, and I think Speaker Johnson deserves some credit of this, of separating it up to build different coalitions for different parts of the bill, passing the parts separately and then integrating them together, was a good way to get it done. But the question is, will the aid, at least to Ukraine, come in time that the Ukrainian government will be able to stop the next Soviet Russian offensive?
Yeah. Megan, your observations about how Speaker Mike Johnson handled this. It's also notable his change in attitude on this foreign aid from when he was a rank and file member of the House just over half a year ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, internationally, right, there's obviously consequences to both the passage of this bill and had they not passed it. But sort of like zooming in domestically, I think it really highlights sort of the dynamics too between Johnson and the Senate and McConnell are sort of highlighting just the ongoing battle in the Republican Party to deal with Trump and sort of the faction of elected leaders who follow Trump very closely. Because I think, you know, there are some really interesting comments from McConnell specifically about, you know, this being sort of the end of the isolationist push in the Republican Party. And really, that's a rejection of sort of that group in the House that has been voting against aid, especially aid to Ukraine. And McConnell and Schumer, you know, sort of by all reports, have teamed up to pressure Johnson into bringing this to the floor. And that's unusual, given that we call this in political science, the majority got rolled, where a majority of the majority voted on the losing side, basically. And party leaders don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. You look extremely weak. And it's just, I think, this battle between sort of the different parts of the party and leadership to sort of take back control over the direction of the party. And you just sort of see that played out here, sort of a lot of different interactions.
Mm-hmm. To your point, Megan, about Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, on Tuesday before the vote, McConnell blaming former Fox News host Tucker Carlson for the months-long delay in getting this package to the finish line.
I think the demonization of Ukraine began by Tucker Carlson, who, in my opinion, ended up where he should have been all along, which is interviewing Vladimir Putin. And so he had an enormous audience, which convinced a lot of rank-and-file Republicans that maybe this was a mistake. I think the former president had sort of mixed views on it. We all felt that border was a complete disaster, myself included. And Chad, you remember covering the phases we went through. First, there was an effort to make law, which requires you to deal with Democrats. And then a number of our members thought it wasn't good enough. And then our nominee for president didn't seem to want us to do anything at all. That took months to work our way through it. So we ended up doing the supplemental that was originally proposed, which dealt with not all problems. It didn't solve the border problem, but certainly addressed the growing threats at the moment.
So Mitch McConnell there walking us through the tortuous path over months to get this foreign aid approved. And Megan, that's what you were talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the other sort of interesting thing here, I think, to flag is that for a long time, political scientists have thought of the party as sort of being made up of voters, of sort of the party organization and leadership, and then also leadership in the government, who people in that party. But sort of recently, a lot of scholars have suggested extending it to think about the partisan media. And I think this just, like, McConnell is really admitting sort of full force how much party leadership in the government and the party organization have lost control of the Republican Party and lost it specifically to sort of the partisan media and the electorate, that they sort of can't rein it back in this like post-2016 era.
Yeah. Wayne, to you on the foreign policy aspects of this, I wonder, do you believe significant damage has been done to the Biden administration's effort to help Ukraine repel Russia's invasion? The funding impasse dating back to last August, when Biden made the first emergency spending request for Ukraine. I mean, we have to wonder how this will be seen in years written in history books, I guess. Who knows if there will be books with history in them, but you know what I mean, Wayne.
Yeah, and I think we don't know the answer yet. It depends what happens in Ukraine. If the Ukrainians manage to hold the Russians where they are or push them back, then it will be seen as not doing much damage. But if the Russians should, over the summer, gain significant ground, then it will look like a disaster, and it will look like domestic politics has impeded the U.S. goal of keeping Ukraine free and staying close to the NATO alliance.
Right. The question here by critics here is, what is the exit scenario, the exit game here? In reading some analysis, Wayne, do you agree that the most realistic scenario for Ukraine is probably not to return to pre-war borders, a smaller nation, but could retaining most of its territory integrate itself economically and strategically with Europe? And one would have to say that's better than an outright defeat, isn't it?
Yes, and I think what's likely to happen is Putin is not going to negotiate until after the U.S. election to see who's elected president. And then negotiations will depend on where we are on the ground at that stage of the game. And if Ukraine holds on to its current territory or most of its current territory, I think coming out of the negotiations will be pretty much what the military borders are at that time. And I don't think Putin wants this to go on for another 4 years.
Okay, we'll be back after a short break with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political analysts, as we pick over the highlights in domestic and foreign policy this hour on our Politics Day. You can join our conversation 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk about the college protests over the Israel-Gaza war continuing to spread. Back in a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Sure, glad you're with us midstream on this edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition with Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our two political analysts. In just a moment, we're going to talk about those spreading college protests, also some in the Midwest. We'll hear some audio from the University of Minnesota in just a moment. But to continue our conversation about the passage of this huge foreign aid package, $60 billion in aid for Ukraine in its war against Russia, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the implications for Speaker Mike Johnson. He had to rely on a majority of Democrats to push through this controversial package. Could cost him his speakership. We'll see. It intensified this foreign package debate, intensified infighting among House Republicans, apparently, splitting sharply on the strategy to deliver assistance to foreign allies. We had social media posts and TV interviews afterwards. House Republicans actually taking aim at one another in unusually sharp terms over the events that led up to the vote. Listen to this, and remember when you do, this is a House Republican talking about other House Republicans. Representative Tony Gonzalez, a Republican from Texas, appearing on CNN's State of the Union Sunday, he was asked whether he believes House Speaker Mike Johnson will survive an effort to remove him from his leadership post. He took the opportunity to criticize some of his colleagues.
He will survive. Look, the House is a rough and rowdy place, but Mike Johnson is going to be just fine. I served 20 years in the military. It's my absolute honor to be in Congress, but I served with some real scumbags. Look, Matt Gaetz, he paid minors to have sex with him at drug parties. Bob Good endorsed my opponent, a known neo-Nazi. These people used to walk around with white hoods at night. Now they're walking around with white hoods in the daytime. What didn't surprise me that some of these folks voted against aid to Israel, but I was encouraged to see by a nearly 10-to-1 mark that Republicans supported our allies on the battlefield.
Oof. Okay. That would be harsh if a Democrat was talking about a Republican like that, Megan. But we have a Republican talking about others in the U.S. House. Where do you see this intense infighting going?
Yeah, you know, so I think it's really interesting because, you know, if we rewind like 10, I guess 14 years at this point to thinking about the Tea Party, we really saw the Republican Party change in a lot of ways to encompass the Tea Party as a faction. But now, right, there's this rebellion against, it's still the House Freedom Caucus, but it's a very different group of people. And so I think, you know, I don't know sort of what's going on behind the scenes, but, you know, it seems like maybe there's an attempt to sort of have a coordinated attack on that faction, because for Republican leaders, it would be a lot easier to do their job if they didn't have the House Freedom Caucus to deal with right now.
Yeah, right. And we should note that none of Iowa's congressional delegation in the House is part of that Freedom Caucus. They all voted in favor of this aid. It was interesting to also read, Wayne, that according to reports, Speaker Johnson's mind was changed by the highest level intelligence briefings he was privy to, on par with what the president gets, learning what's at stake. For instance, that Russia may very well have designs on the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and also on Poland there. Do you think this will cost Johnson the speakership? And then you have to ask, what then?
I don't think so. In the last analysis, I think what's most important for the Republicans is winning the election, and where are the electoral incentives? And I think they have no incentives. The party has no incentives to take Johnson out now, because they've already had a big fight over one speaker, and throwing two speakers out in the same Congress will weaken the Republicans, I think, particularly in swing districts in November. And I don't think, thinking of their self-interest, that most Republicans are going to go in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. College protests over the Israel-Gaza war continuing to spread in our country. Columbia University continuing talks today with student protesters over clearing that in the encampment, the protest encampment there. More than 100 arrested at that university last week. Yesterday, protesters arrested at the University of Minnesota, and students forming a barricade at a college in Humboldt, California. 120 people arrested at NYU. It's quite a list there. But about 300 people staging a walkout at the University of Minnesota, that Twin Cities campus, yesterday afternoon in response to university police arresting protesters at the encampment on that campus. They were calling on the school to divest from companies that do business with Israel's military, including weapon manufacturers. Minnesota Public Radio News was there on the scene. Let's listen.
Biden, Biden, you're a liar!
We demand a ceasefire!
We demand a ceasefire!
Hey, Israel, what do you say?
Hey, Israel, what do you say?
How many homes did you bomb today?
How many homes did you bomb today?
UN men, what do you say?
UN men, what do you say?
Okay, from the University of Minnesota campus on the Twin Cities campus there. Megan, where is the line? The big central question as I see it here, what's being reported on is the line between allowing free speech and making sure our campuses are safe, reports of anti-Semitic behavior.
Yeah, I mean, so this is always the question, right? And it's going to be a different place for different campuses. You know, I think there's a few sort of like important things to note about this. One is that you can't really sort of cast the entire protest or the entire opposition to the protest sort of as like a monolith. I know there's a lot of conversations about keeping, in particular, Jewish students safe. And on the other hand, there have also been Jewish students who have been part of the arrest, who were part of the protest. And so I think, you know, that's sort of the language, especially with, you know, I think that line is harder when you have Congress breathing down your back and congressional Republicans in particular. But that's sort of a lot of the language that's being used is in particular keeping Jewish students safe. And I think this sort of conflation of like the position of Israel and Jewish students together is really against the interests and against what most Jewish students would want and Jewish faculty and Jewish administrators, et cetera. But I, you know, it's a difficult line and colleges are always trying to navigate it. But, you know, I think that Wayne, I don't know sort of what the mood on your campus has been. You know, as a campus that has been relatively free from this controversy in to the degree that these other campuses are not, you know, I think there's a little bit of a sense that this has been an overreaction on the side of college administrators, that college campuses have traditionally been a place where we allow for quite a wide range of free speech. But it is also, you know, I want to admit, more difficult when you have an urban campus. Cornell is quite isolated. So, you know, we don't necessarily have the community or other people like not part of our campus community coming in. And so, you know, places like Columbia have a little bit more of that as an obstacle in terms of drawing that line.
Mm-hmm. President Biden warning on Sunday in a statement, I don't think there is audio on this, but quote, an alarming surge of anti-Semitism. Silence is complicity, the Biden statement read. Even in recent days, it goes on, we've seen harassment and calls for violence against Jews. This blatant anti-Semitism is reprehensible and dangerous, has absolutely no place on college campuses or anywhere in our country. Biden went on, my commitment is to the safety of the Jewish people, the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad. Biden made that point. Vicky, one of our listeners, saying, hello, I was wondering, NPR keeps referring to anti-Semitism on campuses with no supporting facts, ? The facts supporting anti-Palestinian sentiment is everywhere, but the talk of anti-Semitism never has any facts reported, which might justify reporting it as if simply accurate. Well, I don't know. The reporting that I've heard, Vicky, and others, is that we're quoting what Jewish students on these campuses who do feel harassment. Megan, is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, you know, so I think there's groups of Jewish students who are reporting harassment, but I think one of the difficulties here is that there are certain phrases and there's certain language used at these protests that have a very wide interpretation. And I think on the other hand, there is, you know, some groups of people who will interpret sort of any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. And so it's really sort of a perception, I guess different perceptions, that sort of makes the issue more complicated and sort of harder to you know, figure out. But there are, you know, there are reports of Jewish students facing harassment, but of course, there have also been, you know, since October, problems of students who are pro-Palestine being doxxed, being threatened, and also facing harassment. And so there is a general problem right now of backlash against student protesters.
Yeah. Wayne, you've seen campus protests in many different settings going way back to the 1960s. Thoughts with your long view on this latest round of protests growing across the U.S.?
Some anti-Semitism, but there are a bunch of other things operating here that are contributing to the demonstrations. The first, of course, are the daily pictures that are coming out of Gaza of women and children getting killed. This is a sort of thing that mobilizes students. Another thing that's going on, this is the end of the academic year. Students are uptight about exams and final papers and apprehensions in terms of how they're going to come out at the end of the course. And then the third thing is the weather is getting better and it's easier to demonstrate outside. So you got a whole bunch of things coming together here, and I there's always a tendency, I think, for administrators to overreact, which then people that are really uptight then react to the reaction, and this can escalate. I don't think it'll be like 1968 because we have no draft, and they're not worried about people being drafted into the military if the demonstrations don't succeed.
Mm-hmm. Megan, what are the possible implications you see for President Biden and the Democratic Party in this election as this reveals a split in the Democratic Party and has for many months over support for Israel?
Yeah, you know, so I think this is, we've talked about this on here before, that this is an electoral problem for Biden as well as a foreign policy problem. I do think that we've seen over the course of the last few months that the division among the Democrats has gotten deeper and deeper. And, you know, I think that part of the issue here, too, is just like, you know, as someone who's in higher education, of sort of thinking about the other sort of domestic political issue here is people's perceptions of higher education, especially among conservatives who are increasingly viewing college and college campuses as sort of these like hotbed, you know, places of liberalism and indoctrination. And, you know, I think anyone who interacts with students on a day-to-day basis can tell you that that's not really the case. But, you know, I think that's sort of an issue too. But especially, you know, thinking about college campuses in particular and the Biden election, you know, sort of strategy is that young voters are often sort of a key demographic to try to turn out. They turn out at lower levels. Typically, they are more likely to participate in other ways like protests. And you can sort of see that. But I think the big question is like, how does the Biden administration convince, or how do Democrats down ballot convince college voters who are disillusioned with the Biden administration? How do you convince them to show up at the polling place?
Mm-hmm. Let's go quickly to our calls. 1-866-780-9100. Ditris, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, from Mount Pleasant. Welcome to the program.
I am just surprised that our reporters and academicians fail to understand that Palestinians themselves are Semites. That the Jews are not the only ones who are Semitic. Palestinians are.
Mm. Okay, I'm not versed
in. That's a shock.
I'm not versed in that, Ditris. But thank you very much for that comment. Conroy in Des Moines, quickly before we move on, Conroy, what's your comment or question?
Yeah, I'm just making a comment regarding that foreign aid to Israel. Primarily Israel. They are committing some of the most heinous crime on earth, yet we are supporting them with foreign aid, and we shouldn't be doing that. Killing women and kids and stopping food aid, and they make their own rule. They don't abide by any international law, and they think they should do whatever they feel like and get away with it, and it's wrong.
Okay, Conroy in Des Moines, thank you very much. Alex, thank you. Alex, you're on the air from Des Moines as well. We were running up against a break here in just a moment. What's your question?
Sure. Well, it's not a question so much as a comment. I think it's telling that the most ineffectual Congress in history managed to pass funding for military aid and tied TikTok to it. And I think that's what's making a lot of college kids extra incensed over this, is because TikTok is how college kids and millennials have found out about what's going on in the world. And then to see, you know, billions of dollars going to war and continuing to go to war while the rest of us can barely pay rent. And yeah, they're upset because they're young and they're the ones who can get on the streets.
Alex, thank you for your input from Des Moines. Megan, comment on that as a teacher of that generation using TikTok much more than I would, for instance.
Well, Bet, I'm going to out myself here as a TikTok user. But, you know, I think the sentiment about that is it's exactly right what Alex said. They're mad about it. You know, it's a important social media site. It's important for them developing communities in many ways. It is a source of news. Sometimes I'm not thrilled about that. But, you know, the quality of some publications output on TikTok has gotten better. So you can get good information there. But I think, you know, that I'm going to point to, they're mad at Jeff Jackson, a member of Congress who has been, who has used TikTok to his advantage and has sort of turned and like voted to ban it. I think it's really frustrating for students to see that. They feel like it's hypocrisy, and that bleeds over into their thoughts about the institution generally too, that it's just lowering their trust and their sense of efficacy about, you know, because they felt like that was someone who was trying to connect to them and didn't respond to their preferences. They're not his constituents geographically, but they felt like they were Jeff Jackson's constituents in some other way. And so, you know, I think Alex is right, though, that the tension here between these two issues being tied together is it's a lot for young people to sort of process and then turn that into, you know, still supporting traditionally like more liberal candidates, which they usually do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Megan Goldberg, we'll be back after a short break. More from Megan and Wayne Moyer. When we return, we'll move on to talk about the hush money criminal trial of Donald Trump. Prosecutors trying to prove that Trump tried to influence the election, the last election, by hiding a story of an alleged affair. And we've had several days of that, and we'll have coverage tomorrow, as we've heard on that as well. Back with more of our analysis on this politics day, it's River to River from IPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Back with more River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political analysts today. Thanks for all the input from our listeners so far as well. We're going to move on in terms of our issues to talk, of course, about the a little bit about the hush money criminal trial of Donald Trump. Prosecutors trying to prove Trump tried to influence the last election, last presidential election, by hiding a story of an alleged affair. Yesterday in Manhattan, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, testifying he hatched a plan in 2015 with Trump and Michael Cohen, that's Trump's former lawyer, to help Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. That effort entailed publishing positive stories about Trump, negative stories about his rivals, including, you'll remember this one, I bet, one falsely linking Ted Cruz's father to the JFK assassination. It also meant buying and then burying information about possible scandals. Trump's lawyers are set to question David Pecker tomorrow. Again, we'll have live coverage of that here on IPR. The judge not ordering, ruling yet on whether Trump had violated the gag order that bars him from attacking witnesses and others. He scolded Trump's lawyer for not offering evidence in Trump's defense, saying you're losing all credibility with the court. So much to talk about here, but please, your top observations and takeaways. Wayne, what do you make of the trial up to this point?
Well, sort of following up on what you've just said, Ben, I think there are two issues here. It's pretty clear what Trump did. The question is that felonious behavior? And that's what the jury will have to decide. The other question are Trump's remarks outside the courtroom and the statements that he and his supporters are putting on social media. Are they violating the gag order of the judge? Are they, by the process of these social media comments particularly, is that biasing the jury? And how will the judge react to that? And to what extent will that ensure that Trump doesn't get a fair trial? And so I think both of these things have to be considered. What is Trump actually guilty of, and what's he doing outside the courtroom, and to what extent is that criminal behavior?
Megan, your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, I think echoing everything Wayne said, I also think, you know, the thing that had jumped out to me sort of reviewing coverage of the trial is just, first of all, I think it's interesting. It's sort of been bumped pretty low on some of the agendas. If you look at, major national newspapers, which is a little wild, but there's a lot going on. The other thing that struck me was that, so the court is not doing anything today. They'll be back in session tomorrow. But while Trump's in Manhattan, there will also be, we've already sort of talked about this a little bit, Supreme Court arguments about presidential immunity that his team is also arguing. And, you know, I think we all sort of knew this was coming, that there would be like multiple court cases where he can't be in both places at once. And so, you know, I think sort of there's all the legal implications for Trump. I think the political implications for his election are, it's just sort of, you know, I think it's kind of demonstrated that he doesn't actively have to campaign that hard. He's not out sort of like doing all of this campaigning because he's stuck in court. And I had sort of thought that maybe that would hurt his campaign. I think the other question is, at the end of the day, are these multiple court cases straining his finances, straining the finances of the campaign? I think that's still sort of up in the air. We haven't necessarily seen that yet. And then at the end of the day, will any of that matter? Because people are quite immovable, even at this point in the campaign.
Yeah. A quick aside from the political to the comedic aspects of this that I ran across. Late night hosts discussing the gag order hearing. This is from Jordan Klepper. Has Trump ever considered paying himself hush money? The Borowitz report today, the headline, millions cancel subscriptions to National Enquirer after learning stories, may not be true. Well, back to the political. I just had to throw that in. Recent polls show Wayne, a meaningful share of Trump's current supporters say how they would be less likely to vote for him if he were convicted of a crime. Because of how slowly these three criminal cases against Trump are moving, this one may be the only one to be completed before the November election. Now that we are seeing what we may be facing for weeks, this legal calendar and this campaign calendar side by side, what are you thinking? Has it changed your thoughts about the impact it may have on Donald Trump's third run for the White House?
It's still uncertain. I understand people saying they would change their vote if Trump is convicted, but people have said things before in terms of changing their support for Trump. We'll see when it actually happens. Although I think the more negative publicity that he gets, and if he is convicted, it does make it harder to justify, at least publicly, supporting Trump.
Mm-hmm. That case before the Supreme Court, I believe tomorrow on their docket, taking up this huge question of whether the former president turned presumptive GOP nominee can be criminally prosecuted for his efforts to stay in power after the last election. This has to do with the other trials, the special counsel Jack Smith, conspiracy to defraud the U.S., obstruction of an official proceeding for his attempts to overturn the electoral vote count, certifying Biden's victory in shorthand, everything connected with January 6th. Now, Megan, two courts have rejected the former president's immunity arguments before. What are your thoughts on this hugely significant case and how it's likely to be seen by the conservative majority of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, so I certainly don't really know what's going on in their heads. And sometimes they can be a little unpredictable in terms of how they interpret certain reasoning. At least, right, I am not a court scholar and I don't have a law degree. But I think, you know, one thing that this is a question, I think, of their incentives, that the Supreme Court has a lot of incentives to maintain the legitimacy of their branch, to maintain their own legacies. And at the other, you know, on the other hand, increasingly, we see more and more that Supreme Court justices are political appointees. And that political process through which they come to the court spills over into their decision making. Some of them are nominated by Trump. On the other hand, the other courts really rejected these rulings so strongly that I think it would be quite shocking if the Supreme Court didn't do the same. But I also think politically, you know, thinking about the legitimacy of the courts, I wonder if there was maybe some notion that the Supreme Court needed to weigh in on this just to sort of have the weight of the Supreme Court decision behind them instead of leaving it to the lower courts to make the final decision.
Yeah. Wayne, could you imagine this court or any U.S. Supreme Court determining that this former president or any president enjoys absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for any official acts during tenure in office?
It's hard for me to imagine. At one stage, I think one of the justices in earlier hearings said, if we accept your interpretation, does that mean the president could assassinate somebody because they're absolutely free from prosecution later? And I think the justices would have a lot of trouble accepting that. And then the other thing is, what is an official act? Trump is saying what he did after the election in terms of trying to change the results was an official act. What he did on January 6th was an official act. Can the court agree that that's an official act?
Good question, Wayne. I think what Liz Cheney having an opinion piece was either in the Washington Post or the New York Times today, talking about how important it is that this be ruled on quickly. It's not ruled out that this special counsel case led by Jack Smith wouldn't be before the election, but with the delay tactics, I think, none of us are court watchers. we can see, and we will find out if that starts before the November election. Another Supreme Court case to have you comment on, Megan. Hearing arguments today, I think they already heard them, about emergency room abortions, whether a federal law that requires hospitals to provide emergency care applies to abortions in life-threatening situations, now, even in states with strict abortion bans. This is the latest case that could weaken abortion access after the court struck down the nationwide right to an abortion in 2022. A ruling on this one expected this summer. How do you see this case, Megan?
Yeah, you know, so I think that this is obviously an incredibly important case. It's unsurprising that it's come up. We have a patchwork of very different access to reproductive care in the U.S. at this point. But I think what's going to be really interesting, you know, and one of the things I'm in particular watching is that Amy Coney Barrett in the Dobbs decision made some comments basically that, you know, the ease of giving up a newborn for adoption makes the cost of pregnancy almost nothing. You know, as someone who has had children, and I think lots of people who have had children are like, we're sort of look at the 9 months of pregnancy and like do not see that as a cost-free situation. But it was sort of this like brushing under the rug of medical complications that come up from pregnancy, the inherent risk of pregnancy. And, you know, so I'm sort of curious to see what they do with this because they're sort of being confronted with in a very visceral way. You know, some of these stories are quite heartbreaking, women facing existential threat from their own pregnancies, because that's a reality. And, you know, sort of seeing what I think Brett Kavanaugh said something at one point in the questioning about, it seems like you can't reconcile both the rights of a fetus and the rights of the woman. And a lot of people were like, yes, that is the case. And this is directly, you know, sort of pitting them against each other. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how the conservative justices deal with life-threatening situations to the parent.
Mm-hmm. In the final five minutes or so, I wanted to get your thoughts on the recently concluded Iowa legislative session, the 2024 session, gaveled out in the wee morning hours of last Saturday, another session marked by Republican priorities, Republicans in our state in firm control of both chambers. We have Governor Reynolds, a Republican in charge of the executive branch. Iowans soon to see law changes relating to taxes, education, mental health, and more. Of course, the session dominated by Governor Reynolds' proposal that overhaul of the state's area education agencies. But so much during this session, I wanted to ask you each quickly what you had your eyes on, what stood out for you. Wayne, may I ask you first?
Well, one of the things that really stood out to me was allowing teachers and school employees to carry guns. And I think that would be a terrible thing. School districts would have to approve it. But I think it's okay to have security people in the schools carrying guns. But I think giving teachers and other employees? One, would they be well enough trained? And will they be, they're not, they're likely to be the ones attacked if they do, and may not get the first shot away, and they may not even be able to direct the response correctly at the person. So I just think it's a terrible thing in terms of education, and I think keeping guns away from schools is really important.
Mm-hmm. Megan.
Yeah, you know, I think I don't want to be specific about a particular policy, but one of the things that jumped out at me sort of looking broadly at this session, I already talked about, I guess, nationally, the Republicans having discord. And I think we see not along the same lines, but we're starting to see discord among Iowa Republicans. I think that can happen when you start to have a very large majority. But, you know, I was sort of looking at the conclusion of things that, like, there were quite a few policies that Reynolds advocated for, sort of had on her agenda that didn't get passed. A lot of those were actually almost more like moderate policies, like paid parental leave for state employees, prescription-free access to birth control. Those are not things you would typically think of as like Republican priorities. And those things didn't pass in the legislature. I think that's because the governor's not up for re-election as soon as some of our legislators. You know, you also have areas, especially on the AEAs, where you had Republicans, again, voting against the governor's agenda. Mm-hmm. And it's not a lot of them. But you do see some of that discord. And I think we also saw that there's very little reason, I think, that a party with that much control and a trifecta should not be able to meet a deadline to pass a budget. Mm-hmm. And I think there was discord in the party between the two chambers, between the chambers and the governor, that they went over, you know, the sort of 100-day per diem limit.
By a few days. And, yeah, by about a week, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and pulled an all-nighter. I mean, I don't even do that anymore. I don't think I've done one since grad school.
Okay. Megan, we're running out of time. I wanted to give Bill in Sac City a chance to weigh in quickly before the hour ends. We don't have much time. Bill, thank you for waiting, but you wanted to address this latest session.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. The present Iowa personal graduated income tax ranges from 4.4% to 6%, and the corporate tax is from 5.5% to 8.4%. And I'd like to know what your opinion is of those rates changing to the 3.8% flat tax. And secondly, what are your thoughts on the proposed constitutional amendment requiring a two-thirds vote to change that flat tax?
Wow. Okay. That's hard to do in 30 or 40 seconds. Megan, Republicans wanting to get rid of the income tax altogether in this state. And if not that, then make it just very hard to put it back up, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the thing to watch is at the end of the day, how do you have a balanced budget when you have no income tax revenue?
Yeah, right. And I talked with a reporter in Illinois. I wasn't even aware of it. Illinois has had, we think of it as a blue state, and it is, but since 1969, Illinois has had a mandatory flat tax, constitutional amendment flat tax. The implications for a state when it does that are incredible, and this is the direction that Republicans are going in this state. So that'll be interesting to watch as well. I want to thank you, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne and Megan, thank you so much, and thanks for all the input from our listeners. It's been a delight.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
I want to remind you that tomorrow we'll have a Pints and Politics at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. If you'd like to join us in person, I'll be there with a panel of Gazette journalists. To find out more, go to thegazette.com. Highlights of that we hope to have Friday for you on the program. Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Maddie Willis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.